All right, I apologize, but we're having some technical difficulty with the slideshow, so we're going to go ahead and just give the presentation without it for now. I'd like to introduce Brian Soderholm-Defate. What options did managers have? You know, everyone likes to second-guess the manager, and he's going to tell us about a couple notable notable cases.
Well, thanks very much. There is a problem, I guess, with the computer system, so I'm going to have to basically go without the graphics that would accompany it. So can people hear me now? Okay? All right. I'm going to have to do this, at least to begin with, without the slideshow, because I guess some technical problems. So to begin, managers are relentlessly second-guessed by us passionate fans for decisions made and not made in heartrending losses, and especially those that break a season or define a team's legacy. But as knowledgeable as we fans like to think that we are, especially those of us in Sabre, we don't know the factors that go into these decisions. And what I would like to talk about today is to try to identify some of the possibilities of what Charlie Dressen might have been thinking, and the emphasis here is on might, as he made key decisions in the ninth inning of that game leading up to Bobby Thompson's home run, and the Giants win the pennant. The Giants win the pennant. Now, Charlie Dressen was angry and resentful that Walter O'Malley refused to give him a multi-year contract after he had led the Dodgers to 105 wins and back-to-back pennants in 1953. So he stepped down as Dodgers manager after three seasons. In fact, he probably should have thanked his lucky stars that he was given any contract at all after what happened in 1951. Now, although the outcome of that pennant race certainly pivoted on the Giants' superb 37-7 record after August 11th to close out the scheduled season, Dressen as manager was accountable for the Dodgers' historic collapse. After they won that second game of the doubleheader on the 11th to go up by those infamous 13.5 games, he managed the Dodgers to only a 26-23 record the rest of the scheduled season, which then became 27-25 after Thompson's home run. He failed in the manager's responsibility to keep a good team with a commanding lead going strong even once a pennant seemed certain. Now, to be sure, there were perhaps some extenuating circumstances. And specifically, while the Giants were relentlessly closing the gap, Charlie Dressen's core of starting pitchers was overtaxed and relatively ineffective down the September stretch drive. First of all, he had no real reliable fifth starter after Newcomb, Branca, Rowe, and Erskine at this point in time. And all of them had been pitching relatively not so well in September, down the September stretch. Newcomb finished the season at 20-9, but the Dodgers lost four of his first five starts in September, during which his ERA was 5, and in which he went as many as 7 innings only once when he shut down the Giants on September 8th. Preacher Rowe, well, he had the best season of his career at 22-3, but in his last two starts, he gave up 8 earned runs in 9 2/3 innings. Carl Erskine lost 4 games in September, including his last two, in which he gave up 11 runs, 8 of them earned, in 10 1/3 innings. And Ralph Branca, well, he lost 5 of his 6 starts in September, including his last 4 in a row. And in 4 of his September starts, he had an unsightly earned run average of 11.36, in which he failed to go even 6 innings. And then, of course, there's the case of Dressen famously losing faith in his young rookie right-hander Clem LeBine, who could have been the savior of the Dodgers' 1951 season if Dressen had only let him. Thrust into the heat of the pennant race at the end of August, LeBine pitched a complete game victory in each of his first 4 major league starts, giving up only 4 earned runs in 36 innings. So you would think Charlie Dressen might give him a little bit of slack when he finally had a game, bad game in only his fifth start. He loaded the bases in the very first inning, and with the Phillies' Pudd'nhead Willie Jones coming up to bat, Dressen ordered LeBinn to pitch out of the stretch. LeBinn went into a windup, Jones hit a grand slam home run, and Charlie Dressen, being Charlie Dressen, refused to forget, which is probably a very good attribute for a manager, but also not to forgive, which almost certainly, I believe, cost the Dodgers a pennant that year, because he did not use LeBinn in any meaningful role the entire rest of the scheduled season, which at this point was 9 games. The Dodgers now had a 4-game lead. And as that lead went from 4 to 3 to 2 to 1 to none, LeBinn was sitting on the bench despite those 4 excellent starts, first 4 starts in his major league career. He didn't get into a game until the very last game of the scheduled season when he worked 1 inning in relief against the Philadelphia Phillies, a game the Dodgers absolutely positively had to win to force a 3-game playoff with the Giants, which they did in the 14th inning. And after Ralph Branca lost the first game of that 3-game playoff series on a 2-run Bobby Thompson home run, well, Dressen had no choice but to get over his anger towards LeBinn because he really had no other alternative. And LeBinn pitched a gem in the second game of that series in the Polo Grounds, shutting down the Giants 10-0 and raising the question, would a playoff series even have been necessary had Dressen not put him in the doghouse and had used him for a couple of starts in those remaining 9 games? They would be preparing perhaps for the World Series against the New York Yankees instead of having to go to the third and final playoff game to determine the National League pennant, which Don Newcomb was pitching on only 2 days of rest. Newcomb, in fact, was being asked to pitch significant innings for the third time in 5 days in the high stakes, winning is the only option game. This is the same pitcher whose performance in big games Charlie Dressen would later deride as being a terrible flaw. Well, notwithstanding his manager's uncharitable assessment of his gutsiness, the Dodgers would not even have been in position competing for the pennant on this very day were it not for Don Newcomb's excellence and heroic efforts on each of the final 2 days of the regular season. First, on the next to last day of the season, on only 2 days of rest after a complete game victory against the Braves, he shut out the Philadelphia Phillies to keep the Dodgers' hopes alive. And then the very next day, after Preacher Rowe got bombed out early, he came into a tie game in the 8th inning. The game went on and on and on. Newcomb pitched 5 2/3 innings without surrendering a run. He gave up 1 hit, but he did walk 6 batters, which I think is of some significance. He was removed in the 13th inning after walking back-to-back batters with 2 outs. The Dodgers won in the 13th inning. The Dodgers won in the 14th inning. Now, a 3-run 8th inning gave Don Newcomb a 4-1 lead to work with as he took the mound for the bottom of the 9th at the Polo Grounds. He had worked 8 innings and had faced 28 batters, which meant that he had now faced 87 batters in 22 2/3 innings in 3 games over 5 days. Or, if you want to look at it a little bit further out, 123 batters in 4 games and 31 2/3 innings over 8 days. In a word, Don Newcomb was gassed. And we are now at the beginning of Charlie Dressen's worst inning in baseball. Now, there are various versions of Charlie Dressen telling his team to keep it close, I'll think of something. No doubt, as that fateful 9th inning unfolded, Charlie Dressen thought through the various possibilities and made key decisions based on his best determination of what moves would best secure the final 3 outs that would return the National League pennant to Brooklyn for the first time since 1949. And in addition to the objective game circumstance at any given moment, Dressen, like all managers, was influenced by who he had on his roster and also by gut instinct. And never underestimate the importance of a manager's instincts, especially if he's a manager like Charlie Dressen, who considered himself a strategic genius, able to parse a situation and to think of something, perhaps something more unusual or different from what most managers ever do, would think of to outwit the guy coaching, managing in the other dugout, or in this case, with Leo DeRocher coaching in the third base coaching box. Drustin made four key decisions leading up to Bobby Thompson's home run. And once again, I want to emphasize that I'm going to do some speculation here on what he might have been thinking. We don't know that he actually was. So the nightmare begins when Al Dark leads off the ninth inning with a single. This brings up the left-handed batting Don Miller. Drustin orders first baseman Gil Hodges to hold Dark close to first, rather than have him play off the bag and cut down the hole between first and second. And scribes in the press box were wondering about this because the Dodgers had a three-run lead. They needed only three outs. And Dark's run in and of itself was irrelevant. So what was Charlie thinking? Now, while it is possible that Charlie Drustin was inattentive to the circumstance, it seems more likely to me that Charlie Drustin knew exactly what he was doing. May not have been the right thing, almost certainly was the wrong thing, but I believe he was probably so focused on getting those final three outs and so concerned that should Dark somehow come around to score, and especially should he score before an out was made, that that would lead to an unraveling, a cascade of runs that would erase Brooklyn's lead, and that he played it as though it was earlier in the game. Well, as it turned out, Miller did in fact single into right field, a play on which many thought that had Hodges been playing a more normal position, he would have gotten at least one out. So now you have runners at the corners, nobody out. Monty Irvin comes to the plate, very dangerous hitter. Drustin goes out to the mound. Newcomb reassures him he can get the last three outs. But according to Roger Kahn, baseball writer to whom Drustin was pretty close, Drustin's managerial instinct at the time was less about whether or not to take out Newcomb than whether or not to replace Rube Walker behind the plate with Roy Campanella, a far superior catcher and certainly much better able to motivate and to focus a very fatigued Don Newcomb. Campanella had not played in any of the games in this series because he had a leg injury that was preventing him from running. Charlie Drustin, whatever his instincts were, decided to keep Rube Walker. And on the surface, this seems like the perfectly logical decision to make, because a major consideration would have to be the huge expanse of foul territory around home plate at the Polo Grounds that Campanella could not possibly cover on a bum leg. So on the merits, that seems a good decision. But Kahn also writes that another major consideration that Drustin was mulling over was his concern about being second-guessed and crucified should he bring Campanella in, that pop foul scenario come unfolds, the batter with a new lease on the at-bat gets a devastating hit, and the Giants go on to win the pennant, the game in the pennant. If Kahn's account is correct, that would suggest that Charlie Drustin allowed his personal ego to get in the way of his managerial decision-making in the most important game he had managed to this point in his career. Now, ironically, Monty Irvin actually did pop up into that huge foul territory, but it was a play for the first baseman, not for Rube Walker, still at catcher. Whitey Lockman doubles, a run scores, but Miller breaks his ankle, sliding into third base. Another point of some significance that I'll get to later. This brings up the dangerous Bobby Thompson, brings Drustin back out to the mound because now it is obvious Newcomb is completely exhausted. He cannot go on. But the problem facing Charlie Drustin is, who's he going to call? Because the underlying reality that he certainly knew is that the Brooklyn Dodgers really, the underlying reality was that the Brooklyn Dodgers really no longer had a bullpen worthy of the name. Well, now, they had a pretty decent bullpen for most of the year, April through August. But since September, it had been a shambles. Now, a major reason why was because of Clyde King's situation. Now, most of us remember Clyde King as one of a long line of Yankee managers under Steinbrenner, both after and before Billy Martin. But in 1951, he was the Dodgers' relief ace. At least he was until August 22nd. On that date, he had appeared in 38 games, and in fully half of them, he had contributed directly to a Dodgers victory, either with a win himself or a save. But he had now also pitched more than 23 innings in 11 games over 26 days, and that had taken a terrible toll on his arm. Clyde King would never be the same again, and I do mean ever, and certainly not in the 1951 season. He appeared in only 10 more games with an ERA over 10 and had not pitched since that final game. He had pitched the final game of the season against the Phillies, where he gave up 2 runs in 1 inning. So he's not available. Who else was there potentially for Charlie Dressen? Well, I had a list of names on the graphic. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I'd like to suggest one possibility, which would have been Bud Podbielen, who got the win in relief of Newcomb on the last game of the season and had also appeared in relief of Branca after game one. And he had been pitching very well. His ERA as a reliever in September was 1.35. But he also had very limited major league experience, and it appears that Dressen never considered him. He had Branca and Erskine warming up in the bullpen. Bobby Thompson is coming up, and Bobby Thompson was batting in 1951 to this point, .333 against both pitchers, and he had knocked both pitchers for 2 home runs. The difference was that in 3 games against Ralph Branca since the beginning of September, Thompson was batting an even .500 against him, 3 hits and 6 at-bats, including 2 home runs, whereas against Erskine, while he was hitting .333 against Erskine, both of his home runs had come way back in May, and he had not faced Carl Erskine since early August, and at that time, Erskine had retired Thompson all 3 times he faced him. Now, the story goes that Erskine bounced a pitch in the bullpen, and that's what decided Dressen on coming in with Branca. Now, the subtext of that is usually portrayed along the lines of Dressen was losing his grip, that he wasn't thinking clearly anymore in the heat of the moment. What is he thinking? Letting Ralph Branca pitch to a guy, Bobby Thompson, who was treating him like a batting practice pitcher since September, just because Oyska bounced a pitch? Well, what I'd like to suggest is that Charlie Dressen knew exactly what he was doing. And the concern he had was that Carl Erskine in recent games had been having trouble finding the strike zone. In his last 12 and a third innings, he had given up 8 walks, only one of them intentionally. So when that pitch was bounced in the bullpen, Dressen may well have thought, I can't rely on the guy in this particular circumstance. So even if the decision to bring in Branca was reasonable, given the alternative, and I believe it was, if Dressen was in fact concerned about Erskine's recent inability to pitch consistently within the strike zone, it was still an immediate decision to make, and that is whether to pitch to Bobby Thompson with first base open, the tying runs in scoring position, and only one out, or pitch to Willie Mays, the rookie waiting on deck. And after Mays was another rookie, Ray Noble, who had come into the game in the top half of the inning as a defensive replacement after DeRocher had pinch hit for starting catcher Wes Westrum. Now, Bobby Thompson was on a roll with a hot hand. He had 2 hits in this game already, extending his hitting streak to 15 games. He had hit safely in 22 of 23 games. And he had been batting .457 in that time with 6 home runs. Willie Mays was in a funk. Not only did he have just 1 hit and 10 at-bats so far in the series, not only was he just 3 for his last 32 in at-bats, not only had he struck out 10 times in his previous 32 plate appearances, but Ralph Branca totally owned Willie Mays. Branca had faced Mays 15 times and retired him 17 of those, 19 times and retired him 17 of those times. So Charlie Dressen could have been thinking in his manager's mind that he would rather intentionally walk Bobby Thompson and load him up rather than risk Branca pitching to the big Scotsman, even if Willie Mays were to drive in a run while making an out. That's an important caveat, mind you, because the next guy up was Ray Noble. And he might have asked himself, what are the odds that a backup catcher and a rookie with only 141 at-bats in the major leagues, who is batting only .247 on the season and barely over .200 against right-handed pitching, what are the odds that he could win this thing for the Giants? Now, deliberately walking the potential winning run, as an intentional walk would have done, put him on base, would not have been an optimum move, and most managers, especially in Dressen's time, would have considered would not have even considered doing so. But in this case, discretion may have been the better part of valor, because Thompson was hot, Mays was not, And Charlie Dressen, having had to bring Clint Hartung in to run for Miller, who broke his arm, his ankle, no longer had a viable pinch-hitting option for Noble waiting on deck. Walking the locked-in veteran to pitch to the struggling rookie, and maybe even rookies, would have been a move worthy of a manager who prided himself on his ability to think through a situation and outthink the other manager. It would have been unconventional. But Charlie Dressen went with the conventional wisdom and allowed Ralph Branca to pitch to Bobby Thompson. And we all know how that turned out. And now I'm done without any graphics, unfortunately. So, any questions?
I think you failed. I won't say failed, it's a bad word. Remember the previous year at the last game of the season?
With the Phillies?
The Dick Sisler. Yep. Sisler had already gone 3-for-4 against him, and Sisler hit the ball out of the park on Newcomb. Thus, the Phillies won the pennant rather than going into a playoff. Do you think that could have influenced Dressen just the team you leaned in?
Well, first of all, Dressen wasn't the manager that year. That was Bert Schotten.
Schotten was the manager, yeah. But you know, Schotten didn't replace Newcomb, and he probably should have.
That's right. And I think the choice to replace Newcomb was essential because, you know, Newcomb had... was just shot. You know, he was shot. He was completely fatigued.
So I'm saying that maybe this was running through when he got rid of Campanella had said if he would catch me, he thought he could get Newcomb through that last inning with it against the Giants. And I just wondered whether or not the previous year was a little bit of impact on Charlie Preston's thinking.
Yeah, I don't know.
But Dressen was a little bit of a... Well, he wanted to show up the rupture anyway. That was sort of his fault. But thank you very much.
Well, I read where Clarence Bud Pot Wheeler's, my widow, now, and years later, she was lamenting the fact, why didn't he bring in Bud? And what was your comment to that? He had pitched too little or something?
He had very little major league experience. In fact, he had pitched. He was the one guy in the bullpen who had a relatively exceptional record for the Dodgers in September. If I believe correctly, his earned run average was like about 135 in about seven games, and he had won the final game of the season against the Phillies in relief of Don Newcomb. He had also pitched one inning of shutout relief in relief of Branca in the first game. My explanation was that he also had very limited major league experience. And you're talking about needing to get two more outs for the pennant, and Dressen may not have trusted a guy who didn't have, you know, much experience in a high-pressure situation like that.
Yeah, and you also mentioned that Preacher Rowe had not been effective, even though he had this tremendous year.
That's right. And my personal, I haven't read anything to confirm this, but the following year, 1952, he was bothered throughout the season with arm problems, which in fact limited his number of starts, and I wouldn't be surprised if that was basically showing up at the very end of the 51 season. It is interesting to me that he did not appear in any of the three playoff games.
Question of Hodges not holding on, that sort of makes sense because you want to keep the double play in question. Mueller battled a slow runner. Seems like, you know, holding him on is not a particularly controversial thing.
Well, it was controversial at the time for the same reason that, you know, these days if you have, you know, a three-run lead in the ninth inning, you know, the runner on first base, if that's all there is right now, doesn't really mean anything. It's usually after more runners get on base that you start holding guys on. But I think you're right. I personally believe that Charlie Dressen was thinking along those terms, and that's why he asked. He was playing it as though it was earlier in the game,
right,
to get the outs.
Yeah.
I think he did not, whatever happened, I think he did not want Al Dark to score, even if that would have only made the score 4-2. Thanks.